Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Healthcare costs are skyrocketing. Spending on prescription drugs exceeded $22 billion last year. Companies are scaling back insurance plans, and workers are left footing the bill. Is a new elitism taking over the American healthcare system, with only the wealthy able to afford quality care? In this hour, harsh new healthcare realities that may surprise you. We begin tonight with Martha Stewart and the ImClone investigation. Facing the threat of a congressional subpoena, Stewart turned over thousands of private documents to the House Energy and Commerce Committee yesterday. ImClone's former CEO, Samuel Waxhaw, a personal friend of Stewart's, was indicted earlier this month for insider trading. Earlier, I spoke with Tracy Rozan, business reporter for the New York Times. I asked her to describe the documents turned over by Martha Stewart.
Well, they were email records that they wanted and also phone records from her office, and the committee wanted to look at them very badly.
Over what period of time do these records stretch?
They're mostly concerned with the day of the trade itself.
This is December 27th last year.
December 27th, exactly.
We note that you impishly described the orange armful of accordion folders as though they were a fashion accoutrement, but what's the smoking gun they're looking for in these 1,000 documents?
What they're particularly looking for, I believe, is records from her laptop that she sent from the plane. She was traveling to Mexico that day. And what they particularly want to look at is whether she sent any emails to her stockbroker or back to her office, perhaps to her business manager. I think they're particularly interested in the business manager's own telephone records from the office as well, to just see who called whom and try and get some kind of trail there.
So the dynamic that they're concerned with is that maybe Martha Stewart or her broker or through her broker or through the head of ImClone had advanced knowledge that the drug had been rejected as a cancer treatment, that would obviously mean that the stock would be headed down. Did she get that, and did she instruct her broker to sell, to act on that?
Right, and act on it with information that, in fact, was in some way illegal.
Do you think that handing over this 1,000 documents will put her in the good graces of the committee at this point? Is she now seen as in compliance with what they're asking?
No. They really want to see her in person, and they've asked her repeatedly to appear before the committee under oath, and she has refused.
Why do they want her before the committee? Is Martha Stewart being pulled up onto the bad CEO perp walk?
Well, I think what they want to do, or what they say they want to do, is to check with her personally some inconsistencies in various people's stories about her, other witnesses they have, some of which we know about, some of which we don't. Perhaps they do already have some records that they just want to ask her about.
If, as we read, Martha Stewart's broker had heard that ImClone insiders were selling stock, and he passed that on to Martha Stewart, and she acted on that knowledge, would that constitute insider trading?
This is one of the things they want to know, obviously, is whether she was sending emails that say, in some way, perhaps concocting a story about the $60.
You mean that she had set a sell price and it hit that, and so it automatically went practically?
Right, which she is contending was in place, or has in the past at least said was in place, that if the ImClone stock went below 60, that it would automatically sell. She didn't have to have any insider information to do that. That sort of stop loss order is placed all the time.
There's a lot riding on this. Martha Stewart's company, Martha Stewart Living, OmniMedia, is perhaps more dependent on a single individual than any other company that's publicly traded in America. How is the company holding up?
Well, I mean, shares have plummeted. I thought it was interesting that yesterday, when word was broadcast from, I believe, Ms. Stewart's public relations firm, that she would, in fact, comply with the request to submit these 1,000 pages of documents, that the stock actually spiked up, with analysts telling me that this was basically investors being relieved, at least in the short term, that she would not be subpoenaed to produce these records. The committee, on the other hand, is vowing to subpoena her to appear personally if she does not come forward.
Committee Chairman Representative Billy Towson of Louisiana was a guest on Martha Stewart's show at one point. Do you think that the Congressional Committee now feels it can make political points by pulling Martha Stewart before it, or do they risk being seen as picking on one of America's most successful businesswomen?
I think that what the committee, from what I understand, what the spokesman is saying, is that they are trying very hard not to be seen that way.
What about industry watchers? What kind of reputation does Martha Stewart have, not for her on-screen persona, but as a businesswoman?
Well, I think she's seen, or has been seen, as a very savvy businesswoman. Talking to people as a reporter who are involved in marketing strategies and so forth, they feel that she should, in fact, come forward and should testify. And the fact that she is refusing to go before the committee does not help her in any way, either as a diva of domestic bliss or as a businesswoman.
Tracy Razan, thank you so much for joining us.
Certainly.
Tracy Razan is a business reporter for the New York Times. She spoke with us earlier from New York. Unhappy investors in Martha Stewart Living OmniMedia late today sued Martha Stewart. When President Bush came into office in 2001, there was an unprecedented federal surplus of over $3 trillion. We had a moral choice about what to do with that money, says political economist Uwe Reinhardt. Spend on health insurance for 40 million uninsured Americans or on tax cuts for the nation's rich. Washington went for the tax cuts. In a country dominated by affluent elites, the fight for universal health insurance is a losing proposition, Reinhardt says. The window of opportunity for true health care reform, he says, has passed. Income and wealth increasingly determine quality of care. The wealthy get the best care, the uninsured and the unemployed beg for leftovers. Do you feel the changes rippling through the American healthcare system? Through your own paycheck deductions and coverage options, do you see an income-segregated healthcare system on the horizon? Is it already here? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now is Uwe Reinhardt, professor of political economy at Princeton University. Good evening and welcome, Professor Reinhardt.
Good evening. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Thanks so much for being with us. We have heard a lot of news from the healthcare front just in recent weeks about prices going, costs going up again, prices going up again, employers and insurers making new arrangements to deal with that, many arrangements that will end up costing consumers more. What phase are we in the sort of great evolution of American healthcare at the moment?
Well, we tried in the 70s and 80s and 90s to move towards universal coverage. And each time it was proposed, forces came out of the woodwork to defeat that. I think we're now at a point, after 40 years of trying this, where you have to consider it a state of nature that we will not have universal coverage, that we will always have at least 30, 40 million uninsured, and that, in fact, increasingly, we will redefine health care from a social good, which is what we tried to do in the 70s, into a private consumer good, even more like education, where the rich can have private schools and private universities, and maybe we'll have something for everyone. But unlike education, for the very poor, uninsured, we will have literally just the charity care that they can beg together.
You come down with a sweeping and very tough moral judgment on that. But before we go to that, and we will, I want you to help us understand some of the kinds of changes that are taking place right now as a result of where we are in the kind of, I don't know, if we're coming out of the HMO era. We see people talking about things that were new to me. For example, tiered hospital networks, where consumers would be sent to the hospital that their insurance covers them for. In other words, you could get cheaper insurance if you agreed to go to a lower cost hospital. That sounds like an example that could very quickly, or even from the outset, be a kind of income tiered healthcare.
Yes, absolutely. That's one manifestation of it. Or if you are low income, you will be in tightly managed HMOs with gatekeepers, where you may not get to see a specialist, and you may get generics rather than brand name drugs. That isn't always bad, mind you. Mm-hmm. You can certainly survive on that and make it, but there will be this kind of tiering.
And the other thing we're seeing is employers pushing more costs onto employees and what's called consumer-driven health policies. What does that mean, Uwe Reinhardt?
Oh, well, that's just to put a fancy name on basically rationing health care by income class. You got to have fancy names to market this. The idea would be the following, that your employer, or perhaps even ultimately government, but initially your employer would give you only a catastrophic insurance policy that starts kicking in only after you spend 4,000 of the family's money out of pocket. So you have a deductible of 4,000.
Very large.
Very large. But the employer would deposit into a medical savings account for you, say, $1,500, so that the first $1,500 you would get from the employer, but then the next $3,500 would be on your account, would be in your household budget. Now, what would be the effect of this? What it would mean is if you are healthy, young and healthy, you probably wouldn't even have $1,500 worth of expenditures per year.
So you're a winner.
You're a winner because the money stays with you and you can bank it for later.
It accumulates.
Or you can use it for visits to the spas and ultimately, I bet you, even massages. Stuff like that will be covered. But if you are chronically ill or belong to a family that has chronically ill members, you will always spend more than $4,000, so you will have to budget out of your own budget $3,500 every year.
Which is kind of back to the Victorian era situation where if you get sick, watch out, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
We read today in USA Today, just one example, a woman named Laurel Kaufer, 40 years old, self-employed. She said, four premium increases in the last 11 months for a policy that covers her and her two children. She now pays $300 a month with a $1,500 deductible, and she pays 40% of her doctor bills. She's effectively carrying the risk on her own shoulders.
Yes. And, of course, there are many economists who think that that's just great because people will be prudent consumers. You get these people. Mostly, I would say, though, mostly people who talk like that themselves are in the top fifth percentile of the income distribution.
Mm-hmm.
Virtually all of the ones I know who talk like that. So to them, a $4,000 deductible is not a big deal because they make $150,000.
What does it say to you? You're a political economist, Uwe Reinhardt. What does it say to you about the moral fiber of a nation that's willing to wade into this kind of water where medical care depends on income pretty directly?
Well, I don't want to make moral judgments. I'm a European and Canadian, so my social ethic was programmed in another country.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be not nice for me to cast moral aspersions. However, I'm sort of stunned to live in a nation where politicians cite Christ in every speech and then behave this way. I mean, it's one thing if you were to say, look, we're a tough bunch of people, and we just simply think we're a meritocracy. If you're poor, it means you didn't really try hard. And if you didn't try hard, you don't deserve hard. I mean, if you gave me all that, I could buy it. But I kind of find it hard that this country considers itself the most Christian country in the industrialized world. Is that what Christianity was about? I used to be one. I studied the New Testament inside out. Mm. I have different memories of what Christianity was supposed to mean. And that's what I mentioned in my editorial.
We'll talk more about that. There's a lot going on in healthcare. If you haven't noticed, if it hasn't shown up in your paycheck, it may soon, or in your health insurance policy, or in your relationship with your employer and paying for healthcare. How are you faring in the healthcare jungle out there? Have we missed our chance at national healthcare reform? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston University.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the new healthcare crunch, about its winners and losers and beggars. Our guest tonight is Uwe Reinhardt. He's professor of political economy at Princeton University. The question is, are you prepared to live with a system of healthcare elitism, of healthcare haves and have-nots? Are you ready for an American healthcare system starkly segregated by income? And is your employer asking you to pay a bigger piece of your insurance costs? Already, we're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Uwe Reinhardt, you've written very movingly this week about what you see as a missed opportunity that really blew by us very recently. You write that federal budgets, this was in the Boston Globe this week, federal budgets can be viewed as memorandums in which the president and the majority of the Congress tell God about the moral trade-offs they have made on behalf of the nation. If that's the case, Uwe Reinhardt, what did we learn about moral trade-offs in America from last year's budget process?
Well, as I said, I actually spelled out the memo that was written, and it said, "Dear Lord, thank you very much for the surplus you gave us. If it's a choice between spending it on the low-income uninsured to help them get insurance or to give tax relief to the well-to-do of America, we'll take the tax relief. Thank you very much." Signed, George Bush and the majority of the Congress of the United States. That memo was written. Now, and I then go on to say, as somebody who used to be a Christian, I wouldn't call myself that anymore, who remembers the New Testament, I wonder if the Lord would actually appreciate that kind of memo. But the truth is, we wrote it.
Talk to us about the realities of the opportunity you see as having been missed.
Well, it used to be a maxim among political scientists in America that you cannot get universal coverage if it means the middle class that's well insured would have to sacrifice for it, mm-hmm. either take a tax increase or have fewer benefits. And that was the accusation with the Clinton plan, that the fear was that the middle class would lose free choice and have to pay more taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Now came the window of opportunity where we had a huge surplus, $3 trillion, not counting Social Security, $3 trillion in the next 10 years.
At the beginning of 2001, I guess.
At the beginning of 2001. We could have given the uninsured help without taxing anyone else because the money was already there and without taking any benefit away from anyone else. We've never had this opportunity in the last 30 years. We won't have it for the next 20 years.
But was there even a serious conversation about using that projected multi-trillion dollar federal surplus to bring universal health care? I mean, we all remember what happened under President Clinton in the early days of his term when a huge health care reform effort collapsed. Mm-hmm. Was there serious conversation about it last year?
There was not. I mean, to give you a measure of how it was, I wrote after this bitter presidential struggle, mm-hmm. I said, if you want to heal the nation, why not heal us around universal coverage by helping the uninsured? Both parties can agree to this. Bush would look great. I couldn't even get that editorial published in the Washington Post, which pretends to be liberal, but is anything but. And I wouldn't call myself a liberal. I just said there was an opportunity. The money was there. The need was there. And it could have been done. And both parties could have sort of coalesced and healed the political wound. Mm. But you couldn't even get it through the Washington Post.
Uwe Reinhardt, what are the consequences of that missed opportunity for health care and for Americans' lives?
Well, it depends what social class you belong to. If you're low income, sort of marginal to the economy, always at the verge of being unemployed or make $20,000-$30,000 a year. It's tough. Very often your kids get sick. You will not go to the doctor. You will wait, hoping, because, you know, for a family like that, a $90 physician bill is a big hit on their budget.
Mm-hmm.
And you wait and hope nature will take care of it. And when it doesn't, you get very critically ill. Then, of course, the safety net does kick in. You can go to the emergency room of a hospital. They will take you. And then you get hospitalized. But we know from studies for people with asthma, people who are insured have far fewer hospitalizations for asthma than people who are not. People who are not wait till they get really sick, then they get admitted.
But do you see, even in the middle class, at least the lower middle class, these new mechanisms bringing a kind of income tiering into healthcare even there?
Oh, yes, of course. I mean, we saw that in Boston with the boutique medicine. That's just a natural expression of that.
This is doctors setting up to serve well-heeled patients.
Who pay them a retainer and then have their cell phone number and have 24/7 access to the doctors. That's a natural phenomenon of this. But there's another. There's a great researcher at the Harvard Law School, Elizabeth Warren, and she did a study on bankruptcy and incidentally found that medical bills are the second most frequently mentioned cause of bankruptcy in the U.S. So you got these people who work on Route 28,
mm-hmm.
and they have a nice job. Well, it turns out they were in telecommunications. They lose their job. They have a nice house. One of them gets sick, and they're going to lose this house,
mm-hmm.
and they're going to have to declare bankruptcy. I personally think it's a pretty crummy society to live with that fear. But this is the fear middle-class people have to live with.
You talk about the American healthcare world today as a sea of dissonance. You say it makes ours the messiest and, in some ways, the most dishonest health system anywhere in the world. What do you mean by dishonest?
Oh, I mean by dishonest the following. We train doctors to treat all people the same. I know this. I know a medical school. I'm on the board of one. Our daughter is a medical student. And doctors are trained to say, to be perfectly egalitarian.
Mm-hmm.
But then we turn around and develop a payment system where for a Medicaid child, we may pay $10 to the pediatrician for a visit. But for the state legislator's own children, mm-hmm. we pay that same doctor $80. Now, this doctor is not to see that the legislator signals him or her relative social valuation. Clearly, the legislator is saying treating that inner-city kid is worth $10 and treating my kid is worth $80. And then to expect the pediatrician not to react to that is just dishonest.
Mm.
You know, many doctors take care of this by simply not taking Medicaid patients. I don't blame them.
And we've all heard the stories. We're talking tonight about the new healthcare crunch and perhaps missed opportunities as well. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. We've been talking with Uwe Reinhart, professor of political economy at Princeton University. I want to bring into our conversation now Judy Fader. She's professor and dean of policy studies at Georgetown University. Good evening and welcome, Professor Fader.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. Judy Fader, we've been hearing from Uwe Reinhart, and I'm sure you've read his work. You know how renowned he is in the field. This extremely critical view of missed opportunities in the last years, and I must say, a pretty gloomy view of the road ahead for American healthcare sinking deeper and deeper into a kind of income-tiered system. Do you share that view of the future lying right in front of us?
Well, before I get to the view of the future, I want to say that I always welcome Uwe's critique, honest and challenging characterization of the American healthcare system. And I've been listening for a little while. And Uwe, I'm sorry I missed the Globe editorial, but it sounds like, as always, you have called people appropriately on the carpet for the choices that Americans make.
It packed a strong punch, let me tell you.
It always does. And I endorse the values and the judgments behind it.
But is there a but somewhere in here?
Yeah, but's coming. I guess, well, it's not, I don't know that Uwe and I tremendously disagree here. I'm just reacting to what he put forward. And what I would say is that I'm no Pollyanna. on the political prospects for universal insurance coverage in the U.S. based on many years of my own experience along with UVA on this issue. But it's always been a challenge, and it continues to be one. And I think what when UVA says we have made, or we made in last year, the last couple of years, a choice between tax cuts and universal coverage, I refuse to accept those as permanent choices. And analyses like UVA's highlights the issues and the choices we still face in terms of rolling back those tax cuts. The comments that I picked up some of as I called in, when you're describing the increased burdens that the middle class is facing in their more limited insurance coverage in the workplace.
Not to mention the 30 or 40 million wholly uninsured
Americans. Not to mention, and let's mention them over and over, the 39 million uninsured Americans. That the recognition that health insurance is unstable, that rising health insurance costs for individuals and businesses, recession, limited economy that endangers health insurance for those who have it, continues to raise as a political issue, or raise the potential for a political issue, of expanding health insurance coverage. And indeed, we need to continue to show people the choices that we can make, as well as those we do make.
But Judy Fader, if
we have the resources, if we're willing to use them.
Well, if getting the tax cut repealed is a big challenge, and you know it's an enormous challenge, getting back the $3 trillion projected surplus at this point looks like something surely outside of anyone's expectation.
Well, the surplus and the surplus and repealing the tax cut are not unrelated. And getting the dollars we need is a challenge.
But without that surplus, without getting it back, is there a hope of universal health insurance coverage?
Well, Tom, I'm not going to tell you there isn't a hope. There's always a hope. And the question, when you say without that surplus, it takes, we need to make political choices to get it, to get it back, to get the resources. Because I think that there's a tendency to act as if the revenues are not coming into the federal coffers, that the nation can't afford universal coverage. Or just as we hear some claim, the nation can't afford prescription drug coverage for Medicare beneficiaries. That is patently untrue. Despite the current economic downturn, we are a very rich nation. The resources are there. What's at issue is the political will to use them. And I think that UVA was quite right to say that when we were sitting on those resources, when they were there as a surplus, was our easiest way to approach it. But this issue is never easy, because whether the resources are in as a surplus or have to be brought in, we are always facing the issue that UVA has raised of redistribution.
Judy Fader, let me jump in here, because we have so many people who want to join us on the phone. UVA Reinhart says, we faced a choice and we flunked, and Americans are going to be paying for it in the kind of health care they get for a long time. Judy Fader says, keep hope. It can still work out. What do you think? Have you fallen out of the health care universe? Are you living without insurance? Do you fear you might? What does our health care crisis say about us as a nation? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Mark is on the line. Welcome, Mark. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. I had a question about the funding of the health care system, and particularly there have been some discussions of a single-payer system on a state-by-state level, and, for example, Massachusetts or California, trying to go their own way and act as a model. And I'm not sort of an idle, you know, person sitting on the wayside. I've really been looking at this and trying to figure out what can and can't be done.
So could states step in if the federal government won't and cover their residents at the state level?
Well, my take on it is that they can't, because if Massachusetts or any particular state tried it, they would, one, have a huge bill to pay and have people swarming from all over the country to try and take advantage of it.
Mark, let me put that to our guest. UVA Reinhart, what about it? If the federal government ducked on this one, can states pick up the slack, or is that possible?
I believe they can't, because Massachusetts under Dukakis actually tried this. You will have two phenomena. One, You may attract people to come into the state. You could probably block that by saying, unless you've lived here for a year, we won't give you coverage. But you would have businesses, or the units that get taxed, leaving the state. And that happened in Massachusetts. They went up to New Hampshire, particularly now with the Internet where businesses are so mobile. So I think for a state alone to do it is going to be very dicey.
So in your view, it's kind of an all-or-nothing proposition. Jim is on the line. Welcome, Jim. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
How you doing?
Just fine, thanks.
I've been listening to both segments of your show today, and I'm pretty close to the median income. I have a chronic illness. I pay $6,000 a year.
So we're speaking to you tonight, Jim.
Yeah. I pay for myself. I pay another $1,000 for my daughter. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think about prescription. And I have a policy that gives me choice, and I wouldn't have it any other way. But the money that I'm spending, the $7,000 a year I spend on health insurance, I could be putting into a new home.
What portion of your income does that $7,000+ represent, Jim?
It's well over 20%.
And that's to cover yourself and your daughter?
That's correct.
When you say you have choice, you mean choice of doctor?
Yeah, I get to choose the doctors that I go to. I don't have to get the referrals.
Right. But, I mean, every Canadian has completely free choice of doctor and hospital.
I think that's great.
Every German does, too. Actually, the U.S. is one of the few countries that experimented with limiting choice.
And every Medicare beneficiary has choice.
Incidentally, yes, that is true.
But Judy Fader, here our caller, Jim, is spending about 20% of his income to keep himself and his daughter covered. Is this what people have to look forward to?
It's not only what people have to look forward to, it's what people are currently experiencing.
Oh, yes.
And I think that highlighting this concern across, well up into the middle class is that's the hope for generating action to address a more sounder health care system for everybody.
Uwe Reinhart, what's happening to the quality of health care for employed people, perhaps middle class, who aren't high income? Are they seeing it whittled away as employers try to contain costs?
Well, I think not for a while because, as I said, the delivery system is actually run by people who have a fairly egalitarian ethic. Mm-hmm. So they will try for a while to struggle with the limited money flow for the poor and still give them very good health care and try to recover that from more well-to-do, richer patients. Like that's what your academic health centers in Boston are trying to do. But at some point, I think that's going to be very difficult for them to do.
Uwe, I would think you shouldn't exaggerate the degree to which that happens because, as you indicated earlier on your citing of the asthma study, we know from lots of experience that people who are uninsured don't get the same access as other people.
Even if they get through the door, they don't get the same treatment?
I participated in a research study some years ago that looked at people who were in hospitals. So they didn't just get to doctors, they got in hospitals. And once in hospitals, they were treated differently based on their insurance.
Oh, that's the one you and Jack Hadley?
Correct.
Oh, that's a famous study. You're right. Actually, I'll take it back.
Well, it's a scary prospect to think that one goes into the medical system wearing a kind of annual income sign around one's neck. That's tough. And if the treatment varies in response to that, Judy Fader, I know we have to let you go, but thank you so much for being with us briefly tonight.
You're very welcome. Bye, Uwe.
Judy Fader is professor and dean of policy studies at Georgetown University. We're talking tonight about the new healthcare crunch, winners, losers, and beggars. How are you faring in the healthcare jungle out there? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the new healthcare crunch, about its winners and losers and beggars. Our guest, professor of political economy at Princeton University, is Uwe Reinhart. He's written powerfully on the kind of moral decisions that we have made, that we continue to make as a nation in regard to the country's nearly 40 million uninsured and increasingly to many middle-class Americans, not uninsured, but struggling to keep up with insurance payments and finding insurance coverage that is not necessarily what they expect. What do you think? Is your employer asking you to pay a bigger piece of your insurance costs? Have you fallen out of the healthcare universe? What does our healthcare crisis say about us as a nation? Is there a moral failure here? Can we fix it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Laura's on the line. Welcome, Laura. You're on the air.
Hi. I think there's definitely a moral failure, and I don't know that we can fix it. But what I wanted to ask Professor Reinhart was if the problem isn't also at the other end, which is that, say we provide universal health care, but we let drug costs be as high as the companies want to charge, and we let them directly advertise, and we let the patent protections, like that they can switch, you know, slightly to something that was you took it every 3 days, every 5 days, now you take it every 3 days, or whatever, and then you get a new patent. And while we basically give so much high-end, high-tech medicine, you know, like practically anyone can get an MRI who asks their doctor for it, are we even going to be able to afford if we're not willing to control at that end?
Laura, you raise a couple of interesting issues there, and thank you for your call. Uwe Reinhart, I guess, first of all, what about the drug cost piece of this? Is any system going to be capable of controlling cost if pharmaceuticals continue to go up so much? And then secondly, there's almost an implication here, at least I don't know if it's what Laura meant exactly, but we hear about consumers' own responsibility for always wanting the latest, greatest, the most expensive thing.
Well, I mean, the issue, there are two issues here. One is drug costs. It turns out that as a percent of GNP, we don't spend extraordinarily much on drugs. There are many other nations, France, Italy, Netherlands, who spend more, Germany, who spend more as a percent of GDP.
Even at the $22 billion that we spent last year?
Yeah. Oh, actually, it was about $150 billion for prescription drugs. $150 billion.
Oh, much bigger.
But drugs is an odd thing. They substitute very often for other kinds of health care. For example, we know from studies if you treat asthma with drugs, you will avoid hospitalization. We know drugs have vastly reduced hospitalization for AIDS. So we have to be somewhat careful when we look for cures for a lot of illnesses. We don't look to surgeons anymore. We look to the drug industry. The problem is that we buy drugs indiscriminately. There are a lot of Me Too drugs that are slightly different but a lot more expensive. And this lady is right. Patients see it on TV and they insist on it. It's maybe 10% more effective, but cost three times as much, and we think we have a right. I had proposed, actually, in the New York Times, that we take 1% of drug spending and create an endowment. That would be $1.5 billion. Create a research institution that is no longer dependent on anyone for money to do research into the effectiveness of drugs so that a doctor could say to a patient, look, you want this new drug, but here's a study. It says it's really not much better than the old drug, and the old drug is one-third as expensive.
And yet that brings up the sort of the second part of the question. If even if the consumer were told that it were only 0.5% more effective, might the consumer in America or anywhere still demand it? We hear about consumers somehow being responsible for the healthcare crisis, that there's a kind of pampered citizenry that wants the best, the most. Is this problem of consumers' own making?
I think it's vastly overdone. We always blame the American consumer. First of all, we're not consumers. For the most part, we're patients. Patients is a Latin name for sick people. Consumers drink Coke, but they usually don't eat drugs like consumers.
And we don't shop for health care the same way we shop for a pound of hamburger.
No, we really don't. I mean, it's not at all. Obviously, you want a good surgeon. You worry about a good surgeon like a good university, like a good high school. But you don't shop. It's a much more serious matter. Now, when it comes to drugs, you basically have to trust your doctor. You expect your doctor to have absolutely good knowledge about the effectiveness of drugs and the price. And you would expect, it seems to me to be moral or morally accepted to tell a patient, look, here's a drug that worked very well. There's one that works a little bit better, but it's three times as expensive. And we're not going to finance that out of taxes or insurance premiums. If you want the more expensive drug, you pay the whole difference out of pocket. That is what is called reference pricing.
what they do in Germany.
And that sounds like a pretty fair idea to you. I want to bring Rita on the air. Welcome, Rita. Join us.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
My question kind of goes along with what you've been talking about, mm-hmm. and that is whether we see healthcare as a basic right or as a commodity. And I think people get up at arms because they do believe that it's a basic right, and therefore all people should have equal access.
What's your perspective, Rita?
Well, I actually think it's more of a commodity, as much as education is a commodity, given our society's standards.
You mean something that people should not or do not have a basic right to?
Well, I think there's a basic level that should be provided for, just as education. If I want to send my kids to public school, which I can do without any cost to myself, then I can do that. If I want to send them to a private school that's going to cost them $11,000 a year for kindergarten or first grade, I can do that only if I have the money to do that. The government isn't denying me education, just as I believe the government should not deny me nor my children the right to health care.
But Rita, are you saying then that if a child needs expensive brain surgery, that's an elective, that's a choice, that's a deciding whether or not you're willing to pay to send that child to Stanford or Princeton?
No, it's not the same kind of thing. And obviously there has to be a decision as to what's a luxury and what's not a luxury. Going to a clinic to wait maybe, let's say, 3 hours to see a pediatrician is obviously not everyone's choice of what they wanted. Or going to a busy emergency room is not what people would like to do. And people who can afford not to do so are already doing so. They're already paying $20,000 a year to have a private physician on call for them 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
So do you think this
is happening?
Is there a downside in looking at healthcare as a basic right, Rita?
Of course there's downsides, but there's downsides to everything. And right now the system isn't working. There are people who are uninsured, and people are unhappy with the care they're getting. People are being denied, even if they are able to pay, being denied access to things. It's, let's say, not as severe as in England. But now in France, for example, they do have that two-tiered system. They have the basic clinics where, let's say, maybe it's physicians in training. Mexico also. Anyone in Mexico can go and get plastic surgery or cosmetic surgery if they're willing to be seen by a physician in training.
And that sounds fine to you. People can make choices then along a kind of ladder of service.
I think so. I mean, it's not fair that everyone doesn't have the same amount of money, but I mean, that's sort of the way things are. That's the way our system, which is based on capitalism, it has been running.
Rita, we got it. Our time is running down. I want to put that to Uwe Reinhardt. How about it, Uwe Reinhardt? What do you hear there?
Well, I mean, you could certainly, and Europe does that, Germany and England, they basically take Germany, have a fairly generous, comprehensive package to which every German is entitled, right? Then if people insist on having the chief of surgery in a hospital treat you or having some better amenities instead of two in a room, just one in a room, you pay extra and you have private insurance. So you can buy out and buy better, but 90% of the people share one system.
So, but is that income-tiered medicine? Is that what you're saying we're headed toward?
No, you don't have to be perfect. The Canadians try to be perfect, and it doesn't work there because the rich Canadians just come to the U.S. and buy the tier that Canada denies them. I don't mind that, look, the top 10% of any population always wants to buy out, in terms of income, 10, 15%. They want to buy out of the social contract and have their own thing. I think that's okay. You can live with this as long as sort of the broad middle class, in particular at the bottom, people don't go bankrupt. You don't have to have – I'm not a perfect egalitarian.
That bankruptcy is what you're seeing now. And Uwe Reinhardt, I'm sorry, but our time is running out. It's been so great to have you, and thank you for your writing and your thinking on healthcare.
And thank you for featuring it.
Uwe Reinhardt is professor of political economy at Princeton University. In a moment, America's first gay comic book character. This is On Point. Since 1941, no evil has escaped the keen attentions of the Green Lantern. But the newest challenge for the comic book hero is more personal. In this year's September issue, the first gay character in a mainstream comic book comes out to the superhero. Bob Schreck is an editor at DC Comics. He worked with Judd Winnick to create the groundbreaking gay character Terry Berg. Winnick, better known to fans of MTV's Real World as a 1994-era roommate, is now an AIDS educator. In this radio diary, Bob Schreck discusses how Terry Berg came to join the Green Lantern.
To sum up who Green Lantern is, basically, he's a young man named Kyle Rayner. There have been many Green Lanterns in the past. He is the current Green Lantern, and he has an emerald ring that responds to his willpower. He's the most powerful superhero there is. And in his day job, he actually writes for a fictional magazine called Feast. When he got the job for Feast, Feast magazine gave him an assistant, and his name was Terry Berg. So he eventually reveals to Kyle that he has a big crush on Kyle. The writer of Green Lantern, Ron Mars, and I had worked together previously on a book when I was working at Dark Horse Comics. During the production of that book, Ron lost his father, and him and I were working as writer-editor, and I unfortunately have a lot of experience with death, so I really seemed to help him out a great deal. In that bonding, I revealed to him kind of some of the troubles that I had growing up and being a bisexual male, living on Long Island, and the kind of Dennis the Menace life that we had out there in the 50s and 60s. So flash forward 5-6 years, I come to work at DC. Ron is the writer of Green Lantern. Ron turns to me. They make me the editor. Ron turns to me and says, hey, I want to do two stories. I want to do a story about Kyle Rayner, who is Green Lantern, about his mother's passing, which would be reflective of Ron's father's passing. And I want to do a story that kind of is reflective of you, Bob. I want to deal with the problems and the issues that you have as being, you know, a bisexual and or gay male. The reason why we chose Green Lantern, really, Green Lantern chose us. It was a book that was handed over to me because of my relationship with the then-writer Ron Mars, and it just kind of evolved. The character is what we hope to be, you know, a modern male who, you know, understands that his specific makeup isn't the only correct way to live on planet Earth, that the planet takes all sorts of different types of people to make it the beautiful place that it is. And he's a pretty open and intelligent guy. I mean, he's traveled the universe, so, you know, gosh, some of the strange things you may see on the streets of L.A. or New York are nothing compared to the planets he's been to. The story that we're about to reveal with Terry Berg and Kyle is the book that will be out in September, is that Kyle is off to a high school reunion in California, and he gets a phone call, and Terry has been beaten severely and is in a coma, reflective of the Brandon-Tina and Matthew Shepard real-life incidents that we've had to endure here on the real planet Earth. Well, the feedback that we've gotten, the letters have been, you know, when they get mean, they get pretty mean. But most of the reaction that we've gotten has been extremely positive. The one that got me, it was very, very simple, and I'm paraphrasing here, but it was from a CEO out in California. He basically just sent this very short letter saying thank you for the issue where Kyle sits down and talks to Terry about his sexuality. And he said he wept, and he only wished that when he was 14 years old, he had had someone in his life that would have been able to say all those things to him. Because, you know, when he read them, it was the first time he's actually heard them in his life, you know, had somebody actually say that, you know, and sum it up so well. And those are the types of moments that really make these things worthwhile.
Bob Schreck is an editor at DC Comics. The story of the Green Lantern starring his new gay sidekick is in the September issue. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you.